Welcome to Innovation Files. I'm Rob Atkinson, founder and president of the Information Technology and Innovation Foundation.
And I'm Jackie Wisman. I head development at ITIF, which I'm proud to say is the world's top-ranked think tank for science and technology policy.
And this podcast is about the kinds of issues we cover at ITIF, from the broad economics of innovation to specific policy and regulatory questions about new tech. If you're into this stuff, please be sure to subscribe and rate us. It really helps.
Today, we're talking to Dennis Shea, who is the executive director of the J. Ronald Terwilliger Center for Housing Policy at the Bipartisan Policy Center. Immediately prior to joining the BPC, he served as deputy U.S. trade representative and U.S. ambassador to the World Trade Organization in Geneva, Switzerland. We're going to talk about that today. Welcome, Dennis.
Thanks, Jackie. Thank you, Rob. Great to be here.
Why don't you tell us a bit about your background and how you came to be appointed to the WTO?
Well, for about 11 years, I served as a member of the U.S.-China Economic and Security Review Commission. And during a period of those 11 years, I was also either the chair or the vice chairman of the commission. And this was an advisory body to the U.S. Congress to examine the national security implications of the U.S.-China trade relationship. That sort of got me into the issues surrounding China's accession to the WTO and whether China was living up to its obligations as a WTO member. But the immediate, the proximate cause of my being U.S. ambassador to the WTO was a call from Bob Lighthizer, who served, as many of your listeners know, as the U.S. trade representative in the Trump administration. And I knew Bob from working with him on the Dole campaign. I also worked at the law firm that Bob was a partner at when I first came to Washington. That was Skadden Arps. So Bob called me up and said, do you want to be a U.S. ambassador to the World Trade Organization? And it was out of the blue. It's not something that I was seeking. And I said, Bob, wow, he said a few other things about the job. And I said, well, Bob, that's really intriguing. Let me check with my wife and I'll call you back tomorrow. And that's how I got the job. So that's how I ended up in Geneva because of a call from Bob Lighthizer.
You know, that's really interesting. Dennis, you know, one thing you didn't mention, because I've testified a couple of times at the U.S.-China Economic Security Review Commission that you chaired and co-chaired. Early on, it was seen as kind of outside the Overton window. It was like, what are these people doing? Why are they looking at these questions? Why are they being so tough on China? I mean, it really had that reputation. And now the rest of the world, the rest of the U.S. has caught up. And now the commission's very mainstream. But it didn't change. The political attitudes and environment changed.
Oh, that's absolutely right. When I was on the commission, I started serving, I believe, in 2007. And we were definitely the outliers. We were viewed in many circles as, frankly, a little bit fanatical or really out there. And it was, as you said, Rob, the whole mainstream thinking in Washington has shifted to the position of the China Commission. We've been warning about practices that China's been engaged in, the trade practices, the intellectual property theft, the military buildup. For many years, the commission was prior to the seeping into the sort of the consensus viewpoint here in Washington. So you're right. It's changed. It's really interesting. You know, initially the commission was viewed as sort of a compilation of, on the Republican side, as national security hawks, and on the Democratic side as sort of pro-union, pro-labor Democrats. And they somehow found common ground in the commission. And I think the Democrats in the commission have a greater appreciation over time of the national security concerns raised by the Republicans on the commission. And the Republicans had a greater understanding and appreciation for the economic, deleterious economic impact that Chinese practices had on the United States. So it used to be, you know, the common wisdom, particularly I'm a Republican, the common wisdom was that, you know, economic security is not national security. They're siloed. That was sort of the traditional Republican view. They can, you know, there's tanks, planes, aircraft, you know, on one line, one column, and then the economy, trade in the other lane. But now there's a much greater appreciation, at least in the Republican Party, that economic security is our national security.
You know, we did an event a number of years ago on the Hill on Ex-Im Bank reauthorization. It was actually a debate. And so there's two of us and two opponents, and the two opponents were conservative free market Republicans. And I always remember this. One of the opponents said, well, look, if for some reason, you know, we get rid of the bank, which we in their view, they wanted to get rid of the bank, and it turns out that Boeing were to go out of business, what difference does it make? We'll just pay more for, you know, for tanker planes for some other company. And play more for bombers. You know, it was like there was no sense that there was this dual use technology. They just didn't care.
Yeah. And there's no, I mean, there's a much, yeah, there was very little appreciation or not sufficient appreciation. I think now there's greater appreciation that you need a manufacturing base to innovate. People say, well, we'll just innovate, but you can't really innovate effectively if you don't have a manufacturing base. And the linkage between manufacturing and innovation, I think, is much more recognized.
Yeah, as my friend and co-author Mike Lynn says, you can't win a war on patents.
Exactly. You're right. Exactly. What was it? Was it Ben Stein who said, if we give away our manufacturing, I'm paraphrasing this, give away our manufacturing, we'll just write poetry. I mean, there's a famous line about that. That's our comparative advantage, poetry writing.
Poetry writing and waste paper export.
<You're right. laughs>
We'll drown them in waste paper.
Many people have argued that the WTO has failed to adequately enforce rules against the Chinese and their unfair trade practices. What's your view? Do you agree?
I spent my time in Geneva basically making that point. I mean, whether it's the intellectual property theft that's on a monumental scale, it's just incredible to me that we allowed it, that we continue to allow it, but we allowed it to go on for so long. The forced technology transfer practices and policies, the massive subsidization, total lack of transparency and reciprocity. So you can read this for our listeners. If the USTR does a annual report on China's compliance with its WTO obligations, and you can just find it on the USTR website. And I think Rob and Jackie, Steve and Ezel of ITIF has done a great job. I've read some of his work providing a scorecard on China's compliance with this WTO obligations. I think that's a great resource for your listeners to take a look at, because that kind of outlines it in a very succinct manner. And fundamentally, China just doesn't. When I was there, I was trying to persuade my colleagues that it's important for us to reaffirm that the WTO is an organization rooted in fair and free trade around common market orientation of its membership. That's fundamentally a market-oriented, supposed to be a market-oriented collection of entities, some more so than others, but everybody basically swimming in the same direction, maybe in different lanes, but a general market orientation among its members. And that's one of the things I try to do, is to sort of reaffirm that fundamental norm at the WTO. And it was difficult to get even some of our friends and allies to support that proposition.
I understand it and I don't understand it. Why there was so much sort of, oh, it's okay, it's all right, you know, they're going to get better, we shouldn't really do anything. Because by and large, until you got there, Dennis, and again, I don't say this as a Republican or a Democrat, until President Trump got in office, there really wasn't much pushback. Now, you could argue it was sort of rising, and if Clinton had gotten elected, there would have been pushback then. I'm not going to make that argument either way, but the reality is there really wasn't much pushback until 2017. And yet a lot of our allies seem to be, you know, in la la land still. They're not doing anything.
No, that is true. I remember very vividly the first sort of major statement I made at the General Council was pushing back on China's accusations against the U.S. with respect to the 301 investigation that we had initiated. And you could literally hear a pin drop in the floor after I finished speaking. No one had ever spoken that way, that bluntly and that directly about China or maybe any other member at the WTO. And I had a couple of members come up to me, representatives, and saying, you know, that was really important that you did that. And I, you know, had other people. I have had people affiliated with the WTO after my service at the WTO saying, you know, everything you said when you started is right, is turning out to be true. Everybody sort of recognizes that now. But getting our Japan, I would have to say, was the closest friend we had at the WTO. They you know, weren't necessarily enamored with the rough and tumble manner in which we went about things. I didn't think it was that rough and tumble, but according to stage Geneva standards, it was. But they were the closest we had to sort of standing with the United States. It was Japan. But, you know, getting the Europeans, I remember we circulated a paper early on in my tenure outlining the trade disruptive impact of China's non-market economic model. It was like a 12-page paper that we circulated to the general membership, and we put it on the agenda of the general counsel, and just sort of outlined how China's system, non-market economic system, is simply incompatible with WTO norms of reciprocity, transparency, market orientation, how they weren't complying with their WTO obligations. I remember giving this paper to the top EU bureaucrat in charge of trade policy, the WTO he was visiting. And I said, I just want to give you a heads up. In a couple of days, we're going to circulate this paper and we're going to put it on the general counsel agenda. And his comment was, why are you doing that? Why are you doing that? And I was like, well, we feel this is fun. This is at the heart of the problem of the WTO. And we need to educate the WTO members about this. But to get the Europeans to sort of concede that the WTO is rooted in market orientation, that was what the GATT was all about. That was what we insisted on. Some of these command economies in the post-Cold War period who were trying to transition and want to become WTO members, they had to inject more market orientation into their economies. That's what the Marrakesh Declaration said upon the founding of the WTO. But to get the Europeans to agree to that, they felt that that would imply, I mean, that's what imply, put that in air quotes, that China could not be a member of the WTO. And so they were very reluctant, well, were reluctant to sign on to anything or endorse that market orientation's at the heart, a fundamental norm of the WTO.
When you really think about that, I mean, if you just step back and look at that, it's really fundamentally bizarre. So it's like you have a club, and the club is for, I don't know, people who like to play bridge, and there's a person in the club who cheats on bridge. They always cheat on, and well, we don't want them to be kicked out of the club because, you know, we have a bridge club. The whole purpose of the WTO is to enforce rules. It's like that's its only purpose, is to get countries to commit to these rules. And so you hear that you have China not doing it, and nobody even has the guts, except you and Lighthizer and the president, President Trump. And to be fair, there were comments by the U.S. government before that.
Sure.
The rest of the, and the Japanese are good, but the Japanese whole mentality or culture is to not really, you know, pick conflicts, at least publicly. What the heck?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, there was a... an element, I think, thinking that, well, there's a liberal wing in the Chinese government that that we need to cultivate more and potentially not alienate, which is obviously with Xi Jinping, which was wrong back then when I heard it, but has become glaringly wrong today. But also, I think there's just financial interests. I don't want to be too direct here. Well, I guess I'll be direct. I mean, the EU trade policy is run by, I think, my perception is by a lot of large European, mostly German car companies and other multinationals that are heavily invested in China. And as a result, they exercise a great deal of influence over European Union trade and economic policy, and they don't want to ruffle feathers. They're making money, at least in the short term. They don't see the longer term issue of being so closely integrated with China. I think that was a big part of the EU reluctance, is that they were heavily influenced by German and maybe some French, you know, large economic interests.
Yeah, when Airbus sales start to crater in China, at least in the next 10 years, and when Volkswagen sales start to crater, because they are going to get rid of Volkswagen. There's no question about it. They're going to shift to their own, you know, Geely and whatever.
Yeah.
They're going to shift to their own EVs, and then the Europeans will be like, "Oh, geez, that didn't work out the way we thought."
I heard Bob Lighthouse, you spoke to the U.S. Select Committee on China earlier this week. He called it the big con. I mean, the big con is bringing Western investment into China. We'll use it as we need it to build up our own indigenous or domestic manufacturers. And once we don't need you anymore, adios.
Well, it's the big con, but it's also behind it is force. I don't know if you remember that one of the Wolf Warriors said, you know, complaining about what Sweden did on something, you know, "For our friends, we bring fine wine. For our enemies, we have a shotgun."
I do remember that.
And, you know, there was this case that I remember I wrote about, because we wrote a long analysis of the Chinese strategy to win in 5G and telecom equipment. There was a EU trade commissioner, I forget his name, back in 2012 or something, and he wanted to bring a case against China for unfair subsidies and other practices on Huawei. The Chinese went to the head of Ericsson and basically said, "If you allow this to happen, your sales will go to zero. We'll just go to Nokia or somebody else, Samsung." And so Ericsson pressured the commissioner and the commission to abandon the case.
No, I do remember that. Is that Peter Carl? Is that the EU?
I don't recall.
Yeah. I remember that case with Ericsson, basically. And it was sort of amazing with the Europeans when the U.S. made a push, particularly during the Trump administration and into the Biden administration, you know, "Don't use Huawei. It's not secure. Use your own." We weren't asking them to use an American supplier for 5G. Right. We're asking them to use Europeans, you know, Ericsson, Nokia, use your own suppliers. Not an American company. So, but that even fell on some deaf ears in certain capitals in Europe.
There was a lot of turmoil about President Trump blocking the appointment of judges to a key WTO appeals court. What's your take on that?
Well, I'm going to correct your language a little bit, Jackie.
Okay.
I mean, appellate body members are not judges, and the appellate body is not a court.
And, okay, sorry.
And, that's quite all right. But that was the impression that many members of the WTO, or some members of the WTO, had, particularly the Europeans. They viewed the appellate body as a sort of international court of law that would create binding precedent, fill in gaps between the various WTO agreements, you know, create an international common law of trade. And that was definitely not the U.S. position, has never been the U.S. position. And it's interesting, you know, that was the biggest concern that they had when I was over there, is what are we going to do about the appellate body? And we made our case extremely clear about the deficiencies of the appellate body. I won't go into length. We wrote a major report. USTR wrote a major report on this, outlining all the concerns, which can't be, you know, papered over with a word tweak here or there, because the words are very clear in the dispute settlement understanding, which is the agreement which created the appellate body, very clear. And the appellate body was sort of ignoring the clear words of the dispute settlement understanding. But I made the point to my colleagues that this is not a Republican issue. This is an American issue. So I've been intrigued and pleasantly surprised, but not surprised, but that the Biden administration has essentially, in the 2.5 years since I left, have basically taken the same position as we took in the Trump administration. But if in the Trump administration, "Oh, these people are barbarians. They're terrible what they're doing. They're tearing down the international trading system." Biden administration takes the same position. You don't hear that at all. But I'm pleased that they're taking the same position. And I guess there's ongoing talks in Geneva about what to do about dispute settlement and how to fix the dispute settlement system. So we'll see where that leads.
So, you know, one of the things I find striking is that the Europeans in particular, but certainly Xi Jinping has made this point, and people have actually believed him, is that we're sort of the cause of this growing protectionism around the world and this sort of decay of the belief in liberal globalism and free trade. And in reality, the decay was all from China. They were the ones that were, you know, really violating the spirit and the letter and the core soul of this whole system. They were the ones that were doing that. And yet the narrative is we're the bad guys. And I just feel like I don't think the Trump administration did enough to push back on that. And I certainly don't think the Biden administration has done enough to push back on that. We need to change the entire narrative really to be focusing on China started this. They need to end it. They won't end it, but they should.
I totally agree. I mean, I agree with you. I mean, the Chinese have been engaging in at least economic warfare against the United States for many years now. I mean, the amount of intellectual property theft, cyber espionage is truly staggering if you believe the estimates put out by various government agencies, including, I believe, the ITC, and then there's the Huntsman Commission, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars of annual theft. I mean, and that we've put up with this for so long and continue to, I think, is pretty staggering. You know, this issue of decoupling, it's, you know, the U.S. should not decouple. Well, I mean, the Chinese, frankly, have been decoupling before. The United States has been sort of reassessing its economic relationship with China with things like Made in China 2025. I mean, document number 9, which warned of the evils of sort of Western liberal thinking, the internet, the great firewall. I mean, the fact is that China started the decoupling process way before the United States even considered it. So I agree with your general point, Rob.
So, Dennis, maybe as a last question, just we're going to finish up. There are people who argue that it's time to create a WTO for free trading countries. You know, and you could think about ways to do that, like if there were a TPP that was transatlantic, kind of just, you know, get the top 30, 40 countries that are willing to commit to more or less open markets, free trade, intellectual property, respect for IP and the like. And then eventually just sort of let the WTO atrophy. That's one option. The other option is try to reform the WTO, which I don't think is frankly possible, and just sort of continue along and have to do unilateral and bilateral efforts. That's a big question. What are your thoughts?
Sure. I mean, the WTO operates by consensus. What does that mean? That means that you have to get acquiescence, at least, of all 164 members. So if you're to create all these new rules on industrial subsidies, state-owned enterprises, forced technology transfer, even intellectual property theft, do you think China will go along with it? And even if you go, they're not going to go along with, you know, these new rules. So I think it's when you have the second largest economy in the world playing a completely different ball game, type of game, than the other significant largest members of the WTO, then it's really tremendously problematic. I like the idea that you have raised, Rob, of creating a DATO defense organization, that economic focused, democratically allied trade organization. I think that's a very intriguing concept where like-minded, market-oriented economies work together when they're the victims of mercantilist practices, and they help each other out and they act in a united way. I think that's really good. I mean, I mentioned Peter Carl. He was an EU trade official. He recommended that we start all over with the WTO and just create a new one without China as a member. I mean, even CSIS, one of the most establishment think tanks in Washington, recommended a couple of years ago that we create a sort of a parallel organization to the WTO with a smaller group of members that are more market oriented. And hopefully that would force the real WTO to up its games up its game in terms of trade liberalization and high standard agreements. So, you know, look, I U.S. should stay in the WTO. I'm not saying we should get out of the WTO. It's a place where people can come together to discuss trade matters, maybe deal with problems, negotiate some things. But for no member of in the United States government in authority should outsource U.S. economic security to the WTO and, you know, rely on the WTO to protect United States economic security. That's crazy, too. Does that answer your question?
That's a great answer. We could clearly go on for a long time. Super interesting and super complex. But we do have to stop. So, Dennis, that was really fantastic. Thank you so much. Also, thank you for your service when you went over there. I know that was not always an easy effort when you're bringing up your family, going to a whole new place and starting a job where you weren't necessarily the most popular person in the room.
Well, thank you, Rob. I appreciate that. And thanks for all the great work. Well, thanks for all the great work that you do at ITIF. You really, and your team does fantastic analysis. And thank you for, I remember your very valuable testimony to the China Commission. At least two or three times you came in and talked to us. So thank you as well.
Thanks.
And that's it for this week. If you liked it, please be sure to rate us and subscribe. Feel free to email show ideas or questions to podcast@itif.org. You can find the show notes and sign up for our weekly email newsletter on our website, itif.org, and follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and LinkedIn at ITIFDC.
We have more episodes and great guests lined up. Hope you'll continue to tune in.
Talk to you soon.